Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Tonight, we have a pretty streamlined show. It is going to be myself and Brody Levesque, the esteemed journalist, will be stepping up as my co-host. So we're going to have a two-man discussion on the Kavanaugh hearings. I will admit right up front that while I was inundated all day with messaging and tidbits and pieces of information about the hearing, Brody is going to have way of a leg up on me because he literally devoted his full attention all day long to the hearings and has a lot of observation to tell us about it. And a lot of insight. Plus, he has a lot of the background and back room connections to tell us what's really going on, what we can expect both in the hearing process and the future. Actually, without further ado, I'm going to bring Brody on because that is kind of core to everything we're going to be talking about. Brody, good evening.
Hey, good evening, Rob. I guess we're going to need to jump into it, huh? God.
So, Brody, I am going to ask that you, because you are in the thick of it, but for people like myself who may not have watched every detail, if you can kind of take us through it a little bit, what happened and the different reactions. How did the day play out? Did it play out the way you anticipated?
Truthfully, yeah, it did. The hearing was laid out in two parts. The morning session was for Dr. Christine Blasey Ford to give her testimony and to answer questions. And then the afternoon session, of course, was devoted to the rebuttal, I guess you could say, from Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And it was a very, very long day. They took infrequent breaks with about a half hour to 45 minutes for lunch. The hearing started at about roughly 10 o'clock Eastern, and it went till, for all intents and purposes, about 7:30 this evening. So it was almost a 12-hour day. It was fraught with a lot of emotions. The hearing room this time was in the Dirksen Senate office building, and I think that the reason they did that as opposed to the normal hearing room, which is over in the more modern Hart office building, is a lot more spacious, was they wanted to preclude the possibility of disturbances. The Capitol Police did an excellent job, and the committee did not allow spectators, except for, you know, invited ones, government types, and members, of course, of the media. So there wasn't any outbursts, and there wasn't anything, you know, in terms of protests. However, for the both sessions, both the morning session and the afternoon session, there were certain highlights of high drama. It was very, very readily apparent that the politics of the morning and the afternoon sessions were the same. The Republicans on the committee and the Democrats are just polar opposites. They're extremely separated. As a matter of fact, in the afternoon session, at one point, Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham essentially had a meltdown and basically went after the Democrats. The general tenor of the morning session was not quite as antagonistic or hostile. And I think the major reason for that was that the Republican majority had a very, very experienced sex crimes prosecutor from Maricopa County, Arizona, Ms. Miller, and she's a literal prosecutor, and so she handled all the questioning of Dr. Ford. The only distraction was is that it was done in 5-minute increments with she shifting with Grassley interrupting, and of course 5 minutes from the Democratic side as the Democratic senators went through the process. Into the afternoon session, although it initially had started off with the special counsel, Prosecutor Miller, starting to do questioning, that quickly went by the wayside, and each and every one of the Republican senators directly questioned Judge Kavanaugh. The Democrats went after the judge in terms of, I think, a credibility and an issue point of view, particularly centering around the argument of the FBI investigation. Both sides framed the argument completely differently. The Judge Kavanaugh and the Republicans kept more or less putting the focus onto the fact that the Democratic ranking member, Senator Dianne Feinstein, her staff, and of course other members of the committee on the Democratic side, you know, had held on to this. They'd kept it a secret. There was a 45-minute delay, or 45-day delay. There was other issues with it. As a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons that Senator Graham exploded in anger. He labeled it a farce. He called it a scam. It was an extremely partisan outburst, but we heard a little bit of that coming from the Democratic side as well. It was a tense hearing on both sides as far as the dais goes. Dr. Ford was clearly petrified throughout the entire process. She answered every question that was posed to her. There was no real challenging of her answers in terms of authenticity, or I did not get the impression that the committee members found her not credible. But I think with the Republicans, they echoed what Judge Kavanaugh said, which was, I didn't do it, but I think she was sexually assaulted. Now, Dr. Ford was extremely clear in her position that she was 100% certain, and this is an affirmation to a direct question from Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin as to the identity of her assailant, and if it was in fact Judge Kavanaugh, and she said 100% certain. And it was just a back and forth and back and forth. In the afternoon session, Kavanaugh's demeanor was, he was angry. There were a couple of times where he was tearful, very emotional, but mostly angry. Actually, mostly extremely angry. And he interrupted and challenged senior panel member, Vermont Senator Pat Leahy. He challenged Senator Kamala Harris of California. It was very antagonistical. Overall, I guess my walk away from the performance of both Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh, if you were to be fair about it, she quite frankly was a lot more credible than he was in his testimony, his demeanor, and the way he treated, you know, the entire process. His demeanor alone was one of such that I really, honestly, truly don't think that's the type of person, you know, you want sitting on the high court, because it certainly was not a calm, measured approach, which was in stark contrast to, believe it or not, Dr. Ford's approach, Rob.
Right. No, I believe it. I've got a couple questions just of what I observed throughout the day and different messaging. The one thing that I sort of took away was that Dr. Ford came across as extremely credible, and one of the people that seemed impressed by her credibility was actually Donald Trump. If reports out of the White House or from the scuttlebutt about the White House was to be believed, and to the point that he actually was angry at White House staff for not preparing him or strategizing around the fact that she was so credible, which may be a little bit of a departure from history and the way Anita Hill was treated years ago with the Clarence Thomas hearings. But from what I understand, there seemed to be a shift where the Republicans were a little more hands-off with Dr. Ford, and then they seem to, I'm trying to find a good way to describe this, almost donut hold the whole reality of what was going on. In other words, in the beginning of the day, this was a discussion by a woman and a witness to something horrific that had happened to her. And then the Republicans shifted that when they sort of realized they weren't going to be able to go up against that directly, and instead threw this at the Democrats, saying sort of like you were looking for something to throw against this Supreme Court candidate, and no matter what it was, and this is just the thing you happen to throw at it, and it's really this horrific thing, and you're hurting this poor guy when, you know, at the end of the day, you're only doing this for the result you want, which is for this seat not to be filled before the midterms, which in itself is not untrue, but it completely ignored the whole facts and situation of what she had testified to in the morning and what he really didn't do a very good job defending in the afternoon. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
That's a very fair assessment. I think that, the first thing, let me address, White House sources have said that the president did in fact watch the entire process. Initially, we were getting reports that the president was unhappy with senior White House officials. But by the time it got to Judge Kavanaugh, the president's temperament had changed to the point where he seemed, at least according to one source at the White House telling NBC News, that the president was in fact happy with the way it turned out and to the effect of, this is why I nominated him. But the day did not start out well for White House staffers, that's true. Moving on, ultimately, the Republicans put on a show. The Republicans accused the entire hearing process of being a circus or a sham, as Senator Graham phrased it. Graham also accused the Democrats of exactly that, holding the seat open he said hold it open until 2020. I think that the inference there is that Senate Republicans and even House leadership have taken a little bit closer look at the numbers for November, and quite frankly, today's hearing truly and honestly did not help them, including in the Senate races. It was nakedly partisan. It was obvious that they were there and they had the filter by way of Prosecutor Miller to act as a go-between, but they weren't buying any of it. The Democrats, on the other hand, And I won't say that it wasn't nakedly partisan on their, you know, part. Obviously, it was. But there was more, I think, of a factor of empathy towards Dr. Ford as a true victim of the assault. By the time we got midway through the afternoon, every senator on the dais, at least as far as the Republicans were concerned, you know, were playing the victim card for Judge Kavanaugh. And that became really pretty obvious. The other thing that struck, I think, most of us in the press corps that observed today's events during the hearing process was that white male privilege is no joke when it comes down to Washington, and in particular this process. You had mentioned briefly Anita Hill. I'll be perfectly honest with you. This was Anita Hill version 2.0. There's going to be a lot of talk about this. I think that one of the things that the Ford-Kavanaugh hearing today did produce is more of a groundswell of anger in the more progressive and independent, you know, portions of the American body politic. I was listening to C-SPAN. They did the radio comments, one-line Democrat, one-line Republican, one-line independent, and it was severely tribal. And even some people on the Republican line, you know, and we're talking literally in a couple of cases, little old ladies, you know, it was weird with them because they didn't buy it. They, you know, because she wasn't raped, she wasn't really sexually assaulted. You know, it was almost like there was a qualifier. And because there was not enough corroborative evidence, which I'm going to get to that in just a second, you know, they didn't believe her. And, you know, it was a cleaned up version of a Facebook post that has got comments that go off the rails. I mean, to use the word troll, actually, in some cases would be nice as a descriptor for some of the people calling in on the Republican side. There was questions from the Republicans, and I think this is where they had a little bit of a failure by putting a special prosecutor in place to ask questions, because, you know, she was hammering away at, well, who paid for your, you know, lie detector test, and who played for, you know, who pays for your legal fees. And it was at that point, actually, one of her attorneys grabbed the mic and directly answered the special prosecutor and said, we are doing this pro bono, both of us, meaning himself and his female colleague on the other side of Dr. Ford. And then they indicated that the law firms were taking care of the cost of the polygraph. But it all, and then of course the next go round of questions all centered on the four people who either were or were not allegedly at this party, and the fact that there was no real corroborative evidence of that. That in the afternoon session in particular, Republican senators were pointing out that one of the women who was friends with Dr. Ford said that she couldn't, you know, verify that this party took place. She didn't know Brett Kavanaugh. So it literally, even though it started off as a he said, she said, by the afternoon session, it got pretty ugly. Going back to the corroborative evidence part of this, the other thing that the Democrats kept hammering away at with Judge Kavanaugh was his unwillingness to commit to having the FBI get involved. The White House counsel, okay, was actually sitting in the room, actually behind Judge Kavanaugh, and Senator Durbin pointed that out. You know, you can turn right around right now and ask, you know, him to stop the process and to have the president get the FBI involved. You know, and in every step of the way, Senator Harris, Senator Horchett, White House, all the Democrats, same thing, you know, you seem like, you know, you don't want the FBI involved. And that seemed to ring true. Now, in the morning session, Dr. Ford was right up front that she had actually asked for the FBI. to get involved.
Right.
There were a couple points in her testimony that revolved around that. You know, I'm not a prosecutor, but I'm a journalist. I'm a political reporter. And quite frankly, Judge Kavanaugh was in the disingenuous category to deceptive category on my BS meter, starting from the minute he started reading his opening statement all the way through to the end of the hearing. It was an angry white male of privilege who was ticked that he even has to do this. And it was showing, and it was really unfortunate, Rob.
Yeah, I think there's a whole cultural aspect of this at play in terms of what you just termed as white male privilege and the history of male dominance against women, being unfettered in the ability to be aggressive, there's a saying about, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas type of concept, and that's played through to frat parties and everything else that, all sorts of bizarre behavior has always been allowed, and it was to remain secret. As it turns out, is many of the biggest victims of that were many, many women who've held that secret for a long time. I guess that's part of my question about this whole process. The one thing that I've seen a lot of today, and we've been in the Me Too movement for a while now, and I've had different people in my sphere of acquaintance come out with stories about being abused. Today in particular, though, I've saw many more of my Facebook friends opening up, many different women talking about abuse and rape that they have had. It's the first time they've told anybody. And I would say at least a half a dozen of those appeared in my newsfeed today of different people opening up. What do you see as the bigger picture here, aside from the politics, aside from the nomination, leading into the midterm, the effect on the country, the effect on the maybe specifically the woman population of the country, the mood of the Me Too movement, what effect is this going to have on that, in your opinion?
It's going to propel voter anger. There was a considerable amount of women folk and men, actually, coming forward talking about sexual assault. And I'm going to use the term sexual assault as a generic catch-all for everything from groping all the way through to, spousal abuse, rape, and that sort of thing. And that's just because it's more convenient, so I don't have to sit there and define every criminal category. So there was a lot of that. And, we were looking at projections on the midterms, particularly in the U.S. House. And even before this got started, there had already been, rising anger, particularly with progressives and independents and even some Republicans. And it had to do with a combination of issues. Issues over gun control, issues over this particular subject matter of sexual assault, Republican Party policies, of course, obviously, in terms of looking at Medicare, Medicaid, healthcare in general, and of course, the fact that now you have a president who has started not just one, but actually four separate trade wars. And consumers are starting to really feel the pinch. And then a tax cut that has driven about another $1 to $3 trillion into the already rather significant national debt. But what today did more than anything else was it clearly defined the problem and the tribalism in the American political system. The stark difference between the Republicans on the panel, I mean, you even looked at the panel, and if you were sitting at the, you know, the witness table and you're looking at the dais and you're looking to Grassley, whose chair, right, it's all male. There isn't a single female there. And everyone's white, okay, with the exception, obviously, of Senator Cruz, who's Latina, all right? But they're all white. And interestingly enough, in a morning session with Dr. Ford, there was a definite lack of visibility of female staffers behind those senators. Now, that was in absolute contrast to the other side of the dais, to Grassley's left, starting with not only, of course, ranking member Feinstein, but all the way through to the last member on the Democratic side, Senator Kamala Harris of California. So, you know, and behind them, you have female staffers and, of course, Senator Booker, who's tall, you know, black, and he's got staff that are black, and, you know, on and on and on. The entire subcontext of this whole thing revolved around the very real issue that's come to the forefront, and it has become the lightning rod, and that is the white male privilege and the toxicity that goes with it. You can't walk away from that discussion anymore in the American political system. It's an impossibility. And, you know, it's, you know, one of my colleagues from CNN was pointing out that this is the last gasp. And I don't necessarily believe that. And the reason I don't necessarily believe that is because if that person that was talking with me from CNN had been listening like I had been, to, you know, the phone lines at C-SPAN on the Republican side, yeah, I don't think it's the last gasp yet. It's an embedded problem. It's something that, you know, the Americans are going to have to work very hard at. But the problem now is it's you guys have got a seriously, seriously divided nation, and you have an extremely divisive, you know, leadership, not just in the White House, you know, but in the Senate. And I will say this now going in. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, made it abundantly clear again today that the Senate will be holding a vote on the confirmation process on Judge Kavanaugh at noon on Saturday. We were told from sources on the Judiciary Committee staff about an hour ago that Chairman Grassley will be asking for a vote at 9:30. You know, the end result's still the same. Brett Kavanaugh will be confirmed as the next Associate Justice on the United States Supreme Court. There's no stopping this. This is a literal train wreck. But for the Republicans, it's a greater train wreck because of what this will do overall, not only come November, but as far as that party goes. And the real reason for this, Rob, is that a lot of younger voters are looking at this and saying, well, now wait just a moment. You know, the Republicans and some of their backers are extremely cynical. They imported two busful of university students from Liberty University, which is down in Lynchburg, Virginia. And, of course, that's Jerry Falwell and his crew. That was the university they founded, and his son Jerry Jr. Right. runs. And, you know, everything that came out of those university students' mouths, by the way, I will note they were all white, okay, was, well, Kavanaugh's our way to stop abortion. Okay, there's really the triggering process to all of this, is that, and I've said this to you before, both on this show, on your other program in Santa Cruz, we've had this conversation privately by phone. This puts in specific relief the underlying cause of about 90% or more of this tribalism. And that is the American obsession with the peculiarity with Christianity that is toxic. It is patriotical. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, produces this kind of thing. The interesting part about it is they're a minority, but they're so wealthy, they're so well connected, and they're so politically powerful that they're able to run the whole show. And now you're beginning to see, drips and drabs of it. And it was on naked display today. And it's really seriously unfortunate. But make no mistake, the Democrats, barring a miracle, and I mean that in all sincerity, they are going to need four Republicans to say no. And if they don't get those four Republicans to say no, then that's it. They're done. Even if Senator Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Jeff Flake of Arizona were to vote against the party, and the fourth position being kind of a kicker because we're not really sure who would dare cross the aisle at that point, with all of them lockstep, the Democrats don't have the votes. Now, it's going to outrage the public. They're going to be pissed, and it's going to, for the first time, throw this high court into an extremely conservative bend that it hasn't seen in probably well over 80 years. I think the last time the high court was really super conservative was during Roosevelt's first administration. So, it's been about 80 years.
Right.
But it's going to be a problem any way you look at it. And it is measured along social issues. And that's just it. It's measured along social issues. Women's rights factor into this. White men of power and influence do not believe women. And they have this thing that, these women are sexually assaulted. And at the end of the day, it seems to be the past. I think that was one of the strengths of the Me Too movement, is that finally enough young people and enough other folks got galvanized. And they woke up to the fact, and they started to fight this back. One of them was successful enough to put a serial molester, assaulter, and rapist in prison just this week when Bill Cosby was sent away for 3 to 10 years. And, of course, I cheered with that one because he's a certifiable piece of rubbish. So there is that.
Yeah, and I want to kind of, before we go off on another subject there, I wanted to go back to, first of all, your assessment that this is going to happen. This is a done deal. This nomination will take place. And kind of recapping what you just said, in that actually could create a huge, powerful surge on the other side in terms of the midterms, turning out people, young people to vote, hopefully the mm-hmm. women vote. Everybody who is outraged will be highly motivated to get to the polls to change what the face of Congress looks like. Kind of want to juxtapose that, however, with an observation that you made online today, which I thought was pretty astute, which was, had this hearing gone kind of quietly and peacefully, Brett Kavanaugh, I think, was positioning himself sort of like Gorsuch did, not that this would play out exactly this way, but that they would be measured and thoughtful about any case that just happened to come to the Supreme Court. But you observed today that Kavanaugh is so seething at the mouth at the Democrats and everything the Democrats stand for, that there's a very good chance that any kind of semblance about that would be by the wayside, and that he would actively seek to be kind of a conservative activist judge on the court, defying and derailing any of the democratic principles, which includes a woman's right to choose, LGBT equality, transgender rights, freedom from discrimination due to religious grounds, as well as gun control.
Would
you like to elaborate
true.
On
I,
that?
Well, Kavanaugh started off his career clerking for Justice Kennedy. But then he went to work in the political structure. He was in the special counsel's office in the Clinton era. He went after the Clintons, and it was more than just the impeachment process against President Clinton. There was the Whitewater, the Vincent Foster suicide. He's hyper-partisan. By the time he got into the George W. Bush White House, he got even more partisan. This is not a measured jurist by any sense of the imagination. What happened to him today has made him frightfully angry. And that's he's got a track record, and he's the type of person where he's not going to let this by. And I think that what's going to end up happening is you're going to see cases that he will be nakedly partisan with. I don't like the term activist judge, because that's not true. And that applies to both the left and the right. What you have are judges that become partisan, and they become partisan based on an interpretive value. When you get someone like Brett Kavanaugh in office, and this is what's going to happen, the only thing that will mitigate that partisan leaning of his, more than likely, ironically too, will be the Chief Justice of the United States, Justice Roberts. I think he is going to end up being the future Justice Kennedy in terms of tempering, some of the more egregious things that are likely to come out of the majority now. Gorsuch is a constitutionalist and a strict literalist. He's shown a bend, but he's not hyper-partisan. Clarence Thomas is extremely hyper-partisan. And he went through the same process as Kavanaugh did during the Hill, and he, too, has held a grudge. That's the easiest way of putting it. Judge Alioto has a tendency to be a little bit more like Justice Gorsuch. But now that Kavanaugh is going to be on the bench, you've got two of them that have been severely burned for bad behavior. They have had, as they have both called it, circus hearings and a disgrace. What was it that Kavanaugh said? Oh, yes, a national disgrace that is forever damaged my family. I believe Justice Thomas said the same thing after the Anita Hill hearings over two decades ago. So you basically have a monster that's been created. Someone who's been hyper-partisan before, is about to become a serious, serious partisan judge when he's seated. And that's really unfortunate. But this is something that if you look at it, Rob, it was to be expected. Again, I think the only thing that may, surprisingly enough, mitigate that in the future will be the Chief Justice. And I think the only reason for that is because, as you know, the Chief Justice is usually the legacy of the court. You know, you hear the courts referred to by the Chief Justice of the time, the Burger Court, the Warren Court, the Rehnquist Court. Now it's the Roberts Court. And I think that when it comes down to legacy on certain issues, and the fact that on a couple of issues, Roberts has actually been more of a moderate, Roberts may be the only thing standing when it comes down to it. So there's kind of a long answer to your short question.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Do you have any feedback on the point of view from people within the court, any of the other justices quietly making any noise on the back end on what they think about all this?
I talked to a friend of mine who writes for SCOTUS blog and is also an accredited SCOTUS reporter. And that building across the street has barricaded itself and circled the wagons. No, they're being very, very, very quiet about this. And I think the reason, more than anything else, with the possible exception of Justice Thomas, is that they realize that the impression that Americans are going to have of the court has just now radically been changed for the first time, and in an extremely negative way. The Republicans did not do the court any favors with today's hearing at all, and Trump certainly didn't do the court any favors by not authorizing the FBI to go ahead and honor Dr. Ford's request. The president drawing the line in the sand, along with the Senate Majority Leader and Chairman of the Committee, Grassley, have created a monster. And again, we're looking at November, and I think it's going to be more of a bloodbath than it's going to be a blue wave, to be perfectly honest with you. And let me make a note here, because I know someone's going to want to ask this question. If the Democrats take the House and the Republicans, by miracle, retain control of the Senate, can the House Democrats impeach the president? The answer is yes. They can impeach, but it is up to the Senate to have a trial, a conviction, and a removal from office. If the Republicans maintain control of that Senate, that's not going to happen. But having a democratically controlled House and impeaching Trump will effectively neuter the Trump administration. It will also send, you know, a message to the other side of the Hill. I'm going to issue a caution here that a House divided, said the 16th president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, cannot and will not stand.
Yeah, no, that's that is concerning. And I think also the one thing, I'm going to go back a few weeks to the passing of Senator John McCain and the desire for bipartisanship in terms of people of opposite parties working together, you know, this tone today obviously sends us in very much the opposite direction. But
it
seems to me that the health of the country really is where we do get a value around bipartisanship, you know, across the board. Brody, I wanted to ask you specifically, I mean, we've already alluded to it, but you know, Kavanaugh gets on the court, the midterm elections go as you predicted. What is the path for LGBTQ rights? What do you see the strength and the pitfalls?
All right. The strength or the pitfalls for LGBTQ rights will not rest with Congress, and it will not rest with the high court. It is going to rest with the circuit courts and with the district courts. And this is really where there's another issue at play that I don't think a lot of members and colleagues of my profession have paid too much attention to, save for a few. And that is the amount of extremely conservative judges that are now sitting on these circuit courts. There is another byproduct to this, too. And that is, if I'm not mistaken, and Chris Geithner from BuzzFeed, who is an attorney as well as a journalist, could probably answer this question better. And, you know, Chris, if you're listening in, call here. It's going to make a significant difference in terms of how these other courts operate. For example, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is considered the most liberal in the United States, the writing justice was, of course, Justice Kennedy. Now the writing justice is going to be Kavanaugh. So you can imagine that the liberal bend to that court's probably going to get sharply curtailed. You know, is there going to be an immediate impact? You know, that's hard to say. You know, keep in mind, too, that you've also got an American government in chaos. You've got major allies who are kicked. You have a trade war started with China now threatening even military action in certain areas. It's, you know, this is a hot mess. You know, the situation with Lindsey Graham, for example, I think that part of the drama and theatrics that you saw today in the hearing was directed at one person watching, and that was President Trump, because I think that Senator Graham was auditioning for the job of Attorney General, because most of Washington is comfortable the Sessions will be leaving after the November midterm elections. And Graham is and has been almost parasitically embedded, if you will, with Trump in the White House. And so, you know, that's a likelihood. So you have to start putting all these factors together. You know, as far as LGBTQ rights go, I mean, it's going to be difficult to, you know, the front lines of the rights battle for the LGBTQI community is not the high court. The front lines are the U.S. district courts and the U.S. circuit courts. And that's really where the focus needs to be. And any of the of my friends in the LGBTQ legal profession, particularly Shannon Minter and John Davidson, both very fine attorneys, will tell you that it's really a grassroots effort, and really that's where it's going to happen. And some of the ways of, quite frankly, mitigating this, and I've maintained this for a long time, will be, you know, local actions, local protests, and local governments,
right,
you know, making changes.
Right. I want to switch because we're sort of running out of time here. One key thing that happened kind of culturally was Donald Trump. He had a couple of things happen this week. One, I don't want to get into a lot of detail, just kind of a footnote of he was laughed at to his face by
yes.
the world leaders at the UN in kind of an unprecedented show of absurdity. But apart from that, his statements this week regarding the accusers of Brett Kavanaugh and himself flew in the face in a way that no public official has done against the Me Too movement. And I realize that, you know, especially for the left, you know, virtually anything Donald Trump says is seen as completely ridiculous. But he kind of galvanized some anti-Me Too movement sentiments in his self-defense and his defense of Brett Kavanaugh. How much legs do you think those statements are going to have in terms of, and some of it's not unfounded, is that, you know, a lot of these accusations are now taken at face value. Somebody makes an accusation and boom, it's real and men are taken down and there's no due process. And, you know, that is part of the new now and the new normal. And he latched onto that. Will he get through? Will he make a point with his defense of that?
In terms of his base support in the American evangelical and Pentecostal communities, they are going to support him no matter what. Keep in mind, these are the people that supported a pedophile in a U.S. Senate seat run in Alabama. They have no shame, and their singular focus is power and maintaining their control of it and maintaining their control of their wealth, which makes them, quite frankly, dangerous. Trump is – the fairest thing that I can say about Donald J. Trump is he is a cleaned-up version of a mafia don. He's basically a John Gotti type without all the F-bombs. He's not very smart, and his tactics are very, very in line with the type of street thuggery that you would see from organized crime. His mentality is very much in line with that, and he's gotten away with it because of his extreme wealth, and he's been insulated from it. The sad thing for the American public is that they have a mafioso sitting behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, and all of these men of power and means have decided that they're okay with that. You know, as far as the sexual assault allegations go, you know, there's a problem with it, and I cannot state enough that it is as John Dean said in a Senate hearing, low 45 years ago, a cancer not only on the American presidency, but a cancer on the American body politic. The one thing that I think the Me Too movement has produced is at least a greater awareness of just how bad that problem and that cancer really is. Whether or not Trump is going to be able to continue to get away with that, Rob, quite frankly, that's going to depend on the American people. And, you know, it really boils down to, well, just exactly how much of that immoral rubbish, you know, from that mafioso do you want to put up with?
Very true. Well, and who? I mean, there's systems. I wish it was just obviously a popular vote, because we already had that, and as we can see, that didn't work. And I think it is, to your point, you know, local level, the effect of other areas where it may not hit directly with him, but you know, the culture is responding across the board. I also think, like what happened today, just from what I saw personally, of more and more people mm-hmm. coming out with their personal stories, that it is sort of reminiscent of gay people coming out, and people who never knew they knew gay people, or people who never knew they knew transgender people, now knowing mm-hmm. people. And it becomes more real, and it becomes something that is more of a personal issue than a theoretical one. So hopefully that environment will also help rectify and change the culture in subtle ways as well as direct ways. Brody, we're sort of winding yeah. down here. What have we not covered around the whole Kavanaugh situation that we should be mentioning tonight?
I think it's very, very critically important here that not only our listeners, but people in the American public understand that the one aspect of the culture in the nation that should do the most good has done the most evil, and that is the religious institutions of all churches, not just the evangelical and the Pentecostal, but the Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church. I think it's time that, you know, the American public really called these people into account and held them accountable, because at the end of the day, what really gives people like Trump and people like Mike Pence and people like Kavanaugh power are those institutions. Pat Roberts more or less had a prayer today. Right Wing Watch posted the video of it, where he was praying to God, okay, to clear up the confusion in the minds of people so that Judge Kavanaugh would be appointed. Yeah, sooner or later, regardless of whether you want to believe or don't believe, the greater imperative here is that the one thing that's supposed to be a mechanism of good in the hands of these few has turned into a mechanism of evil. And if all of these people that can hear my voice, especially the ones that hear my voice that, like myself, are a survivor of sexual assault, go to their local churches and go to their local communities and hold them accountable and say, we won't take this anymore. This has got to stop. Humanity and humans need to be recognized on the merits and content and context of their characters and their humanity. Because at the end of the day, everybody bleeds red. One of the greatest contributions to the tribalism in American politics is religion. When I hear people talk about American separation of church and state, I laugh my ass off, because it doesn't exist. It's a theory. It's time to make it a practice.
Right. Yeah. Solidify it. Well, I want to thank you very much for your hard work today. I mean, you stuck to this thoroughly throughout the day, and you're usually on, you know, half a dozen stories and all over the place. And today it was Brett Kavanaugh all the time for hours and hours. So I want to thank you for that, and as well as, you know, our ongoing partnership here and your work on this program is deeply, deeply appreciated. I also want to give a shout out to, you referred to it earlier, my other radio show. It's actually, I share that with my co-host, Bash D. Eldon, and that show is out in Santa Cruz. That our listeners can hear on Saturday night. You can hear it on the website www.kfco.com. That is 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. This week we are actually playing a rerun of one of our favorite episodes, and this was an interview with somebody, Brody, both near and dear to your and my heart, and that is Brandon Wolf. Brandon was on the Out Santa Cruz show. Brandon is a survivor of the Pulse nightclub shooting. His interview, his candor with Bash and myself was outstanding and very heartwarming and inspiring and touching and important. So I would encourage people to listen to that show if you didn't hear it before. Brandon is wonderful, and as well as we've got astute commentary about cultural happenings. Bash is on top of that and brings a lot of incredible observations to what's been going on culturally. So, so check out in Santa Cruz. Next week, Brody, I know we're working up something exciting for Rated LGBT.
I have a young man who's a performing artist that I think our audience is going to love. Of course, you know me, I like my artists, so I'll probably talk about that a little bit more. One last word, and then I know we've got to go. If you are a survivor or have been sexually assaulted, there is no shame in that. I believe you. There are people that will believe you. And if you have never said anything to anybody, find someone you trust and talk about it.
Very, very important for people who at this time is a trigger. I thank you for bringing that up, Brody. I also want to point out that we are winding up our time across the states for register to vote. And if you are not registered, please go do so. Especially in given states, your vote is incredibly important. And even in states where it doesn't feel that way, I'm in California, and sometimes it feels like we are definitely shouting into the wind. But even in pockets of California, there are key areas where it is actually vitally important that we vote out people who are regressive and keeping Trump and those type people in power. So please get active on doing that. For Brody and myself and the whole Rated LGBT radio team, I want to thank you for listening. We will be back here again this same time, this same channel next week. We look forward to speaking to you, and we look forward to covering the great issues, the LGBT issues that you are concerned about, and bring you the greatest voices who can address them, so you have every bit of information that you need. So good night, and thank you for listening, and we will see you and talk to you next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.